Today on Against the Grain, the left has traditionally been defined in its most radical form as a movement of the working class against capitalism. So what's changed over the last at least half century? Not only has the working class not been at the forefront of radical politics, but radical politics itself has waned. Why have resistance movements become more sporadic? And what lessons can be drawn from the past to re-energize left-wing collective action in the age of Trump? I'll be joined by political economist David McNally to talk about the past and future of radical class-based politics. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The United States used to be the site of some of the most militant class struggle in the Western world. But today, the working class is frequently seen as a conservative force. Is there any truth to that characterization, which dates back to the 1950s and 60s? How should we understand the general absence of mass, class-based, collective resistance during the last 40 years of neoliberalism? Why has the left been able to mobilize people in large numbers on occasion, but not been able to translate those successes into sustained mass movements? And might that change under Donald Trump? To pick apart these huge questions, I'm joined by David McNally. He's an activist and professor of political science at York University in Toronto. He's the author of many books, including most recently, Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I have been his editor. David, one of the pillars of Marxism is that the working class is a potentially revolutionary class who can bring down capitalism. But since at least the 1960s, many on the left have given up on the working class as a revolutionary subject. Why is that?
Well, I think what's interesting is that the reasons for this in the 1960s and the reasons today are quite distinct. And what I mean by that is that in the 1960s, we had come through a period beginning right after the Second World War, pretty much as soon as the war ended in 1945, where working class living standards in the industrial core heartlands of Western capitalism rose persistently year after year after year, so that by the time we got to the late 1960s, heading into the era of the new left that really blossoms in the late 60s, early 70s, the working class in the global north seem to be directly benefiting from capitalist growth and development. Life seemed to be getting better, at least in material terms, in terms of their capacity to afford food and housing and creature comforts of life, automobiles, appliances, and so on. And so the idea became pretty widespread that in the global north, the working class had a material interest in the preservation and expansion of capitalism. And that raised big questions around the famous Marxian slogan that the workers have nothing to lose but their chains. Interestingly, as virtually everyone, even in the mainstream, will admit, working class living standards have not been rising over the last quarter century or more in the United States, Canada, etc. In fact, for the majority of working class households, there has been a declining quality of life in terms of the growing precarity of employment, the downward movement of wages and benefits, the erosion of union protections as more and more work is non-labor, non-union, not protected by collective agreements, and so on. And of course, this has led to all of the discussions as to what happens to the working class anger under conditions of economic and social decline. So it's not that people are today arguing, I think, about a broad-based material interest in the system. What people are rightly registering is that there has been a decline in organized working class opposition, that the retreat of unions their massive social decline, and alongside that, the political retreat of some of the historic parties associated with labor movements, whether it's the Labor Party in Britain or the socialists and communists in France or our own New Democratic Party in Canada, where I live. These parties have all shifted dramatically to the right. It becomes at least a fair debate in what sense they even remain working class parties. And so it is the political presence of a kind of working class opposition, which is, I think, now what the debate is really about or ought to be about. I think those who argue that working class people in the global north are clearly materially benefiting when their lives are more stressed out and more precarious, when there's greater hardship, I think that argument is very weak. But I think where the left must face up to a serious challenge is on this other side. That is to say, the decline of an organized political presence, be it through unions or political parties, of a kind of working class oppositional politics. Now, the one other point I would make in this regard is that we confront, I think, today a really challenging paradox, which is that although organized expressions of working class politics are in decline, they episodically flare up and manifest themselves. And of course, they do so with all kinds of contradictions. But I don't think that there's any doubt but that we ought to read the Bernie Sanders campaign phenomenon in the U.S. as an expression of a kind of searching for a left, class-based oppositional politics. And I say that fully aware of all the contradictions of that campaign having been associated with the Democratic Party and the like. Nevertheless, I think as a broad political phenomenon, we can see there that there is, if I can put it in these terms, an aspiration without an outlet. There's a political aspiration which simply has no sustained organizational expression. And so for me, that's the real challenge at this point. Not that workers have no interest in fundamental social transformation, because I think we can make a very powerful case that they do. I think the real challenge is to show that they have the capacity to do so.
Well, we'll talk a lot more about the present and many of the issues that you're flagging as we go on. But I just want to stay for a moment with the history. You said a few minutes ago that we really need to think differently about how the working class was seen in the 1960s and how they're seen today under neoliberalism. So just staying for a bit more with that earlier period before there was this really significant change in the way that capitalism organized itself. One of the things that seems interesting, striking about how the working class was seen in the 1960s is that with the exception of some radical Marxist groups, in the main, there was an assumption that the working class in a country like the United States, as you say, was invested in capitalism, in fact, bought off, and that the revolutionary subject had to be found elsewhere. And for some people, it was third world revolutionaries, movements in the third world. For other people, it was people of color in the ghettos of the United States, one particular slice of the population. And yet what seems interesting is that, looking back, is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, there was actually an explosion of working class militancy, although a lot of it was really rank and file and interestingly involved women and people of color and people in the service sector, teachers, who are often not the poster children for manufacturers working in organized labor. Do you think that's a contradiction, that that kind of labor militancy took place at a time when so much of the left was not looking to the working class?
Yes, I do think that's right. And I think part of what you're describing is a very long-standing problem that a left which is not rooted in workplaces businesses and trade unions often encounters, and that is the confusion of the often highly bureaucratic leaderships of the labor movement with the rank and file membership. There's no doubt that many of the labor leaders of the 1960s and early 1970s expressed very limited and sometimes even conservative politics on some of the burning questions of the era. Now, we need to be careful there. One of the things which really stands out, for instance, when you look at Martin Luther King's last couple of years is the number of trade unions he spoke to, the number of trade union conferences that he was invited to come and speak both about the civil rights movement, but also about his new call for a poor people's campaign. So at the level of official leaderships, there were some meaningfully progressive unions because of their historic traditions, often going back to the 1930s and 40s. But nevertheless, I think that it's fair to say that on civil rights, on the war in Vietnam, and on the issues that were affecting rank-and-file members in the workplaces, on the shop floor of auto factories and so on, that this leadership was often fairly conservative and out of touch with its members. So if you didn't have direct contact with working-class people or their organizations, it could be very easy to generalize about working-class capacities and political consciousness on the basis of fairly bureaucratic leaderships of, say, the AFL-CIO in the U.S. But interestingly, of course, when we do look at the base of the movement, this was a period of a rising wave of wildcat strikes, that is to say, unauthorized strikes, where workers were simply walking out, protesting conditions of work, tyrannical management, and so on. And arguably, nowhere was this truer, of course, than in the then heartland of the automobile industry, Detroit, where we had rank-and-file worker-of-color opposition groups like the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement. That was connected to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, arguably one of the most workplace-oriented of the Black Power movements of the time. And we know from looking at hospitals and post offices and government offices and so on that there was a kind of political ferment happening, that young workers in particular, workers of color, women workers, were affected by anti-war, anti-racist, feminist movements, and so on, and that many of those radical ideas were being expressed in workplace-based actions as well. So I think it's true that we often have a caricature of what the working class, even in a heartland of advanced industrial capitalism like the United States, was about. And it's very easy, unless you have a kind of ability to look at that grassroots rank-and-file level, that it's very, very easy to underestimate just the political and social ferment and the radicalism that was happening there. And of course, the United States wasn't unique. This was, if anything, even more the case in countries like Italy and France, where we had massive worker insurgencies in the same period, but again, often bringing them into conflict with their much more conservative union bureaucracies.
David McNally is my guest. He's a political economist, author of many books. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. A moment of profound shift took place in the 70s. So preceding that, there had been decades of growth and expansion of the working class affluence that extended to the working class, especially the white working class. Obviously, the working class was and is very racially divided in the United States. And then in the 1970s, a crisis, global crisis of capitalism, and then the imposition of this new neoliberal order, this new way of structuring the economy, of transforming the way people lived and worked. You've started to touch on it, but I wonder if you can talk more about how neoliberalism, the process of neoliberalism, which is often framed as class war from above, but actually is also a bit more complex than that in terms of how it transforms people's relationships with each other, how that transformed the working class. And you used the word decomposition. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, and I'm borrowing a phrase from some Italian radicals here, even if I'm using it with my own sort of inflections, but what I mean by that is that every working class movement creates certain institutional forms, cultural identities, including the music that informs the movement. It builds what Alan Sears has called infrastructures of dissent, by which he means the actual places where working class activists get together, meet, converse, debate, discuss, educate one another, generalize solidarity. And this can be everything from the union halls and union picnics of a certain era to the actual meetings in the bar around the corner from the workplace where you plan a walkout for the next day or the next week. But neoliberalism managed this multi-leveled assault. It's true, of course, it needed to use state power. Ronald Reagan needed it in the early 1980s to break the air traffic controller strike, and that was sort of the signal moment for a broad-based offensive. Margaret Thatcher used it in Britain in the mid-1980s to break the coal miners' union, which had been since 1926 the leading militant left-wing union in Great Britain. If we look at Bolivia, it was the crushing of the tin miners' union in the middle of the 1980s, which was the key to neoliberal transformations there. So absolutely, the state is crucial, particularly in its willingness, its drive to use state power to break very often extremely strong militant sections of the working class. In Canada, the most left-wing union in this period was the Postal Workers Union, and they were criminalized by having their strike made illegal and their president thrown in jail, and none of the rest of the labor movement did anything in response. And so you see all these moments within neoliberalism of direct state confrontation with important working class organizations and strikes. So that opens the door. But at a much more molecular level, employers, corporations are developing strategies to break organization within the workplace. And in particular, this meant beginning to contract out all kinds of work that had previously been done in-house. So General Motors starts to contract out the making of engines and wiper blades and so on to non-union small contractors. Then they start to relocate plants from the much more unionized north and midwest of the U.S. into the much more non-union south or outside of the U.S., particularly into Mexico, over time. So they literally physically break down those places where workers used to gather with some collective agency, and a collective agency which bridged into the community, whether it was the union halls or other kinds of social institutions where working class people gathered, where people told the stories of the strikes that won the union, where there was a kind of culture of opposition which was sustained over the years, and everyone who went into the plants went in knowing the stories of the past battles that got them the union. They went in with a kind of rudimentary class consciousness. Well, when those communities start to disperse, when Detroit becomes what it is and Flint, Michigan becomes what it is, and then you go through Gary, Indiana, and parts of Illinois, and so on and so forth, where older working-class communities, which had been highly unionized, are essentially dispersed, you don't only lose the jobs, you also lose those infrastructures of dissent, and you lose the transmission belts for working-class memory. That's an enormous cultural and political setback. And it means that when we talk about a reemergence of working class politics and working class struggle, we need to recognize that we cannot simply use the old coordinates. The left is too often using a compass that, in a historical sense, is 40 or 50 years old and sometimes more, rather than recognizing that a new wave of working class radicalization cannot take the old forms because the old institutions are gone. The old organizing centers are gone. And that needn't be a cause of despair, because historically what we've seen is these immense cycles in which working classes get very, very well organized, put immense pressure on capital. But the problem is either their agenda for social transformation is going to prevail, or you enter maybe a long period of what seems to be a social compromise, for instance, the so-called welfare state period after the Second World War, where basic union rights and protections were there for a significant section of the working class. But sooner or later, because of the rhythms of the capitalist economy, which is to say, because capital is going to run into its recurrent profitability problems and crises, eventually they're going to go after those protections. And either the workers are able to resist, or they become defeated, as they were in the 1970s in the neoliberal era. And well, that 1970s wave of defeats, of course, carries all through the 80s and often well through the 1990s also. And so that's where the concept of recomposition comes in. Any new mass working class movement is going to have new forms, new infrastructures of dissent, new sensibilities, new cultural forms, including music. You know, I hate to say it to some of the old timers, but it probably won't be Pete Seeger who will represent the kind of music of a new generation of radicalizing young workers today. All of this will change. And that shouldn't surprise us. Nor should we necessarily assume that it will take the form of workplace-based labor organizations always. It may or it may not. In Marx's day, if you joined the union, it wasn't based in your workplace, it was based in your community. It was a citywide, sometimes national, union structure that you were joining, and it didn't have workplace branches, and it didn't have collective agreements, but it was a political organization of workers. And so when I think today, for instance, about the Fight for 15 campaign, were a real mass struggle against low-wage work and precarious work to take off in the United States or Canada or what have you, it's going to need a new organizational form that's much broader than the historic workplace-based collective bargaining unions. I hope it's connected to those as well, but it's going to need to be something much broader. And that's one of the challenges, I think, for Marxism and for the left today, to have that capacity to think about new terrains of struggle, new coordinates of resistance, and what kinds of forms might be starting to emerge today that will speak to a politics of left and working class recomposition coming out of the cycle of decomposition across the neoliberal era.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lillian, and I'm speaking with David McNally. He's an activist and professor of political science at York University in Toronto, author of many books, including most recently Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. And today we're talking about the struggles of the working class, the ebbing and flowing of movements to take on capitalism. And one thing that you spoke about, David, when you're talking about the ways that we need to find new ways of organizing, not be locked into the old forms and new ways of coming together, I wondered if you could talk a little more. You did touch on this, but in talking about how neoliberalism has created obstacles in doing this, the role it's played in the decomposition of the working class, you were talking about both things that happened at the point of production and then these things that happen outside of them, such as union halls. But I wonder if you can talk about the kind of broader role of daily life under neoliberalism, which, you know, can include resting, reading, having children, looking after them, trying to keep yourself, you know, healthy so that you can keep going back to work, and all of these things. How has neoliberalism affected that, and how has that affected the ability, heretofore anyway, of people to come together collectively?
I think this is a huge issue, and one that intuitively a lot of us recognize, but which we have not theorized very well. What I mean by that is that we're all aware of how stressful daily life has become, of how people feel that they're constantly sacrificing sleep, the time with their loved ones, with people who matter most to them in their lives, because the constant speed up of everyday life, of which the speed up of work life is part, but not the whole story. And that's got to do with the privatization of all kinds of things that in robust or more robust welfare states, people could often take for granted. And what I mean by that is the scramble for childcare, for instance, the scramble to look after elderly or ailing parents or relatives. All of these things that we think ought to have robust social services have, of course, been increasingly frayed. And so, yes, there's speed up of our lives in the workplace, and yes, often for those of us whose work involves computerization, work is often invading our home lives as well, where we're doing emails for hours after dinner and that sort of thing. But similarly, care for children, care for the elderly, care for sick and ailing friends and partners, all of that is stretching people enormously thin. And that is a real challenge to the ways in which we think about organizing today. Having said that, it's really important to remind ourselves that just last weekend with the January 21st women's marches against Trump, we saw that the capacity for mass mobilization is still there. So that's not the issue. But there is an issue around sustained organization that I'll come back to. But equally challenging, of course, is the fragmentation and atomization that neoliberalism brings. One of the things I like to always remind people of is that most people don't come to radical politics out of being theoretically convinced. They come through a much messier process, which has a pragmatic foundation, by which I mean they are discovering that certain ways of affecting their world don't work, are dead ends, and others seem to offer more hope and more possibility. But of course, if collective forms of organizing and resistance are less and less effective, and that's one of the things which happened with the decline and retreat of unions, then people are thrown back on individualized solutions. If you don't have a union, or if your union, in fact, keeps buckling to the employer and offering up concession contracts, and you're trying to figure out what you're doing about your children's future, then you've got to look elsewhere. The strategies then start to become highly individualized. And that was happening alongside an ever-increased financialization of everyday life that neoliberalism brought with it. One of the things about neoliberalism is that financial markets got deeply extended into working-class people's lives. Working-class people began to carry more forms of debt than they traditionally historically had, and this included even poorer sections of the working class who had often historically been, particularly if they were racialized, locked out of capacity to borrow from banks and get mortgages and that sort of thing. But then the more you get caught up in these sorts of institutions, the more you're pressured to address as an individual your financial situation rather than to think about these problems collectively. Now, I don't want to overgeneralize that because I think there's a limit. I think in a new wave of growing social resistance, we are going to see debt repudiation kinds of movements, particularly, I think, around student debt. I expect that debt may become a site of collective resistance and organizing in the years ahead. But when that's not on offer, it's your individual problem, and it's deeply stressful, and people are constantly trying to figure out how to borrow from X to pay Y. All of that is part of that fragmentation and atomization, and it would be, I think, very naive for any left movements to underestimate those. What it does mean, I think, is that we need to learn to speak about those. We need to understand that what some commentators have called financial expropriation, that is to say the interest payments that working class households are paying to banks, can become, for many workers, at least equally important to exploitation at work. And so their relationship to financial institutions is going to be a big, big issue, particularly where government is backing those institutions and intervening in them. I think the calls to socialize the financial sector, to bring it into public hands, and all those sorts of issues will be on the agenda in the years ahead, as well as debt repudiation. But coming back to what I said earlier, the fact that the terrain of everyday life has changed is really important for how we think about organizing. We're going to need to think, I believe, about a return to more community-based models. That is to say, not the idea that either workers are going to be able to stay after work somewhere and meet for several hours when they've got to go pick up children, care for elderly folks, and so on. We're going to have to branch out into communities. That is, I think, a real prospect for some of these movements, that is to say that they can get community-based, and certainly I can only speak about what Fight for 15 is doing in the city where I live, Toronto, but that more community-based focus is exactly what it's bringing at the moment. But we're going to have to go a lot more to where people are. And interestingly, I believe that some working-class movements, particularly in places like Bolivia, began to think in these terms in the early 2000s, where they stopped assuming that people would just automatically gravitate to their centers, and they actually went out and found new ways to connect to people at transportation hubs while people are waiting for buses and subways, to distribute leaflets, talk to people, and so on. So there will be new models of organizing, and it's going to have to be very experimental. People are going to, you know, capitalists always use the term best practices. They need to figure out what the best ways are of making workplaces more capitalistically efficient. Well, I think the left needs to think about best practices. What's working in terms of mass-based organizing in communities, around workplace-based issues and so on, and how do we generalize from that? How do we learn from that? So new models are very much going to be on the agenda.
Political economist David McNally is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You mentioned a while back that the problem, contrary in some ways to the historical memory about even fairly recent movements, the problem is not actually mobilizing people, that the problem is sustaining movements in some more long-term way. One can just think of the mass marches that happened in 2003 against the impending invasion of Iraq. Millions of people came out into the streets in 2006. There were the immigrant worker strikes. Obviously, Occupy was another example of people coming out in a mass way, but it wasn't sustained. Do you think this conundrum for the left of mobilization versus sustained organization is partially the product of neoliberalism, and or is it something about how we just really haven't hit on the right form or some combination of the two? How do you understand it?
I think it's something of both. I think one of the things that's really interesting and sometimes incredibly exciting about the forms of social protest that we've been seeing, particularly since the 2008-09 financial crisis, is that they have this capacity to massively seize public space. And there is an electricity when they do that. There is a sense of breaking down certain kinds of social apartheids and reclaiming public space, reclaiming the streets, reclaiming parks and city squares. Everybody senses in some way that urban space has been gentrified and corporatized, that poor and working class people and young people have been driven out of those spaces, in part just because they're often in financial sectors that people cannot afford to regularly patronize and so on. And so when you get these semi-insurgent movements that seize a park by Wall Street or seize Tahrir Square in Cairo or Gezi Taksim Square in Istanbul or whatever it might be, the great mobilizations in Madrid by young people in the early stages of the crisis and so on. Those encampments and the like are electrifying. I think they have a huge purpose in that in reclaiming public space, they can become a site for certain kinds of oppositional energies and education and mobilization. But their inherent limit is what we were just talking about. People have to somehow get through everyday life, notwithstanding the fact that all the excitement is in a square somewhere or in a park. And what those movements have not been successful at doing is linking the very local to these centers of resistance and mobilization. And there's no question, as Occupy was declining, there were clearly discussions about that sort of work happening in a lot of areas. People thinking that campaigns for racial justice, Fight for 15, and so on, could get dug in at local levels. And I think in some areas people did commendable work there. But I think the really difficult problem is that we don't really have the organizational practices yet to be able to link the local with the large scale. It is a problem of different scales and how they interconnect. So we either have really interesting local groups which have no capacity right now or very little capacity to project onto a larger political stage. As a result, they fly under the radar too often, and they're not affecting the wider political culture, even if they're doing great work in a community. Or we have the very large and short-lived mobilizations which briefly seize public attention and quickly start to redefine narratives as to what's happening in the society, but tend not to be sustained. And these problems of scale, which is to say, okay, what kinds of organizations with, if I can put it in these terms, intermediate level kinds of structures can we create? In other words, if we're building Fight for 15 or Black Lives Matter organizations in the following communities, how do we then project on a citywide scale? How then do the citywide organizations link up by sending delegates, for instance, to weekly or monthly meetings on larger scales so that there's a constant transmission from one scale to another, not just, say, from the local to the citywide to the statewide and beyond, but in the other direction as well?
Well, what you're talking about speaks to the desired breadth of movements, and which leads me to ask you, do you think that in building movements to oppose capitalism, that it's the working class, kind of returning to the beginning of this program, that should be the umbrella into which movements take place? And out of that question, I should ask you, how do you define the working class? Is it something that we should define in kind of narrow terms or very broad terms that would then allow for that kind of extra capacity? And if you mean the larger, how do we deal with the fact that we're talking about populations that are very divided from one another along racial and other lines?
Yes. And I don't think there's any easy answer to this question. I would say that I think long term, we are talking about the building of movements which do have a kind of class identity and class consciousness, but that this has to be, by definition, a sort of unity of the diverse. That is to say, it has to be, there's no way you can have a meaningful working class movement today which isn't feminist, which isn't anti-racist, which isn't queer positive, which isn't ecological in orientation. So that we have to, I think, challenge the idea that a class-based movement means a movement of that minority of workers who have trade unions, for instance. Trade unions can, and I hope will, be a significant part of broader working class movements. But working classes are not reducible to the organizations that may or may not be collectively grouping people together around workplace issues. So when, for me, the working class is all of those people who are reliant on their ability or the ability of those with whom they live to find wages. And they can be unemployed, they can be partly employed, they can be seeking wage labor, they can be moving in and out of combinations of working for a wage and doing other little kinds of so-called independent contract type work. But those who don't have the capacity to live off their investments. Have the capacity to live off property.
And so that would include also people who often identify as middle class, well-paid professionals.
It would. For me, there's no question that even if you are a relatively well-paid teacher, you still rely on your ability to sell your capacity as a teacher to some employer, be it a school board or a private school or what have you. And if you're not living off property, if you're living off the work you do, then to me that means you're working class. And it doesn't mean that you're in industrial work necessarily. The majority of workers today, in my definition, are in what we loosely call the service sector, even though I have lots of quibbles with that because when I walk into a McDonald's, it sure looks like an assembly line that's producing the Big Mac to me when I see how it's being done, even though it's being called service work for all kinds of reasons that are unique to economists and government statisticians and statisticians and the like. So, yes, I see the vast majority as working class, but there's no way in my mind that there can be a meaningful working class movement today, meaningful, by which I mean a mass working class movement, which, as I say, isn't a racial justice movement and isn't a feminist movement and isn't a pro-queer movement and so on. We have to recognize that there have never been working class movements that somehow had an uncomplicated working class identity without other social oppressions being a significant part of how class is experienced in our society. To be a black woman worker in our society is intrinsic to every one of those dimensions is intrinsic to what it means to be working class, because you're a racialized worker, because you're a gendered worker, and you suffer distinct kinds of gendered oppression within our society.
Well, let me end with this question, although I'm not trying to have you be an oracle here, David, but I do wonder if you feel like the Trump presidency and the already mobilizing opposition to it has the capacity to lead to some kind of wider anti-capitalist politics, or because it's focusing on a Republican, is it likely to be locked into a sort of politics that keeps wishing for the Democrats to come back, to have them be the voice of sanity here? How do you think this all could go?
Starting with your first question, I definitely think it has the capacity to move in an anti-capitalist direction. But I don't think there are any guarantees in that regard. And I think anybody who's honest with themselves has to acknowledge that there is a dominant form of politics, which is a kind of liberal incorporation of whole layers of social protest movements into the apparatus of neoliberalism in a way that de-radicalizes them. And at the same time, I think that incorporation is more likely to be challenged today for all kinds of reasons. One of the reasons I think that it's more likely to be challenged is the fact of austerity capitalism that we've been living through since the crisis of 2008-09. I see no evidence that capitalism is in a position to return to robust, sustained growth rates. I think it's going to continue in the sort of form we've seen in recent years, which is to say, at best, growth rates that keep up with population growth, and much of the time, growth rates, particularly what we're seeing in most of Europe at the moment, which don't even keep up with that, so that unemployment levels, real unemployment levels, remain high, and that the quality of work continues to deteriorate, that it's more casual, more part-time, more precarious, low-wage work. And in that circumstance, in those conditions, it's more difficult to sell, just follow the great neoliberal messiahs. I think that's a key to understanding Trump's election. That is to say, the failure of the neoliberal elites of the Democratic Party to be able to rally enthusiasm behind Hillary Clinton. I think that does speak to a disaffection and a disengagement from that kind of neoliberal politics. And so that's the hope, if you will, that these movements, or at least a significant layer of these movements, could begin to crystallize in another direction. The other thing I would add is that it's very clear from all kinds of work that pretty serious sociologists have done, that there is a younger generation, really globally, that has not been shaped by Cold War mentalities, who had no problem, for example, coming back to the Sanders campaign, which I mentioned earlier, no problem politically identifying themselves with a politician who declared himself socialist. Now, we can discuss the limits of Bernie's so-called socialism another time. What matters to me is that the Cold War scare meant so little to a younger generation of people coming into politics. We continue to see this very favorable idea of socialism registering in an awful lot of polls. What that means, it seems to me, is that a non-sectarian socialist left that really was organizing around the issues of the day, speaking in thoughtful and creative ways to how we move movements forward, ought to be able to begin to become at least a meaningful minority pole of attraction. That's going to raise all kinds of challenges. What kind of organizing do you do to keep that moving forward? And I won't pretend for a moment to have the answers to that. But I think what it says is that this is a really interesting moment of challenge for very broad forces on the left, because there's no doubt there is a dominant pattern out there, and that dominant pattern will be for the political energies not to find an outlet, for a kind of decline after the big events that means that organizations don't come out stronger, that anti-capitalist currents and movements don't come out stronger, and the default reaction will always be, therefore, the Democrats as the alternative. And I think that's out there as a danger, unquestionably. What I think a lot of people know that right now. I think, ironically, one of the things that's going to be difficult for the Democrats in their politics as incorporation is that Trump means business. I don't think this stuff is rhetorical. I think we're talking about an intensified neoliberal offensive where they want to go after so many historical gains of the working class and the social movements around voting rights, reproductive rights, around the environment, around indigenous rights, around policing and racial justice. I think they want to go after so many different sections of oppressed and working class people in this society that there are going to be ongoing fightbacks and resistance. And I think it's going to be hard for neoliberal elites like the Democrats to incorporate those people. But the problem is, if serious forces of the left don't rise to the occasion and have a kind of multi-year perspective, not the idea that next week is the key, but that we're rebuilding a left over the next decade, then if we can't rise to that occasion, then for sure, someone else will fill the vacuum, even if it's rhetorically. But I think there are openings. I think there are possibilities that are genuine, even if there are no guarantees.
I've been speaking with political economist David McNally, author of many books, including most recently Monsters of the Market. David, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure, as always, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.